This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. It's our Doctor in the House series. Dr. George Lee, consultant neurologist on the line with me. It's a Friday, George. How are you today?
Mira, it's a Friday. We're always happy on Friday and it's always sunny and traffic jam on Friday. Obviously, out there is doom and gloom. Am I talking about the weather or am I talking about the health of the nation?
Neither are you talking about the traffic because there is no traffic out there, George. It's not doom and gloom, la. We don't want to end the week, you know, on that sort of note. So we're going to try and help ourselves understand what the situation is so that we go back empowered and not thinking that it is all doom and gloom and there is light at the end of the tunnel. Isn't that what we're going to do, George?
Absolutely. You know, I can see a glimmer of sunshine out there and a glimmer of hope. The rain has stopped. Hopefully, the guest today will tell us that it's not really that doom and gloom out there.
It is not. And we're not talking about Parliament today. We're just going to focus on the pandemic and make sure that we understand and see that light. Welcome to the show, Dr. Kumita Tevadas. She's from the Infectomics Cluster, Advanced Medical and Dental Institute from University Science, Malaysia. How are you today, Dr. Kumita? Because when I saw this Infectomics Cluster, I'm like, is there a cluster that we missed? What is it? You want to just explain to us?
Sure. Good afternoon, Mira. Hi, George. I think we all of us sort of agreed cluster at this time is not, there's no positive connotation to it, but infectomics actually means infectious diseases. And the omics part is a lot of what we do, which is a lot of molecular work, a lot of cell biology work. So it's a combination of infectious diseases and omics, hence infectomics.
Okay, I really thought it was economics, actually. It's not really quite the case. So today we're going to be discussing COVID-19. What is the situation we're in at the moment? What do some of these numbers actually mean? Mm-hmm. You know, we talk about a lot about positivity rate. We are looking at numbers, daily numbers, and we're saying now, you know, people are now saying, don't look at daily numbers. You're looking at this risky Delta variant that's going crazy. So what is going on? We're going to try and get our heads around it. If you have a question for us, give us a call. It's 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, or tweet us at BFM Radio. Let's start with the daily numbers, Dr. Kumita. We've hit over 1 million cases already. But what does that mean in the grand scheme of things? With cases in the five digits and easily breaking all-time highs, how concerned should we be about these daily numbers?
Good question, Mira. And I think that's something that's sort of on everyone's mind right now. I think when we first hit 1 million, it was probably a moment of stunned silence among all of us. But I have to say it was probably not unexpected because we are seeing cases increase worldwide and we sort of have to be very cautious when we look at the numbers. So it's not just the active cases that we should look at, but definitely we should pay attention to also the breakdown of categories that patients fall into. So just sort of a general explanation or description, most patients that we see right now, 50% of them fall into category one, which means they don't actually have symptoms. So, you know, people don't even realize that they are infected. We are mostly concerned with categories 4 and 5. These are the people that need hospitalization. So these are the numbers that we should pay close attention to just to make sure, you know, our hospitals are okay, our ICUs are okay. And then, of course, something that you mentioned earlier, positivity rate, that's definitely something that, again, we should pay attention to. What sort of variant is prevalent in the community, because that also affects transmission rate. And of course, you know, to sort of end this on a positive note, our vaccination rate. So that is a great sort of check and balance to what's going on right now. You know, we've sort of hit 500,000 doses every day. So that's 1 million people that we're vaccinating in the span of 2 days. So that's almost, yeah. So you're doing pretty good, I think, in that sense.
Okay, goodbye. We've got nothing left to talk about. You just summarized the whole show. Okay, let's go to positivity rate. You know, so every time we see, you know, new, you know, high numbers, daily numbers, then I hear this chatter like, yala, they must be testing more. Then when the numbers come down to 13,000, yala, they're not testing enough. You know what I mean? So can you explain this positivity rate? Because WHO recommends getting to a positive positivity rate of less than 5%. But what does that mean?
Okay, so I think when we talk about positivity rate, it's as the name suggests, out of 100 people that you test, how many people actually test positive. So of course, you know, if it's just one person, then that's great. You know, that's very, very little people in a community. But in the community context, it's easiest to sort of imagine it as like a pyramid. So the ones who are at the top, the peak of the pyramid, those are the ones who are at highest risk. So, you know, that's sort of who has strong symptoms, whereas the ones at the bottom, those are the ones who don't have any risk. You know, they have no symptoms. If we have limited number of tests that we can do every day, say for example we're only going to test 100, then the logical way of going about it is to test at the very top, which means that chances are you would find a high number of people who are positive, but then that also means that you're not sort of testing the people at the bottom, so you may be missing that people at the bottom. So ultimately, we want to be able to achieve 5%, and that's sort of, you know, within the community, people who are not at high risk, people who don't have any symptoms.
You're on mute.
Such a big... Kumita, what influences such a big variation on the daily testing numbers? I mean, what are the factors that determine that such big variation?
Yeah, and just to go back, sorry, yeah, since George mentioned that WHO recommends a positivity rate of less than 5%, Malaysia now is between 10% and even slightly over 12%, actually. So that's very far away. What does that mean?
Okay, so good questions, both of you. So right now, a lot of what we're doing is targeted mass screening. So we are looking at factories, definitely a lot of testing going on in different parts of Klang Valley, even here right now. So I'm in the northern region, so we're seeing a spike in like Kedah, for example. So definitely we are going to get higher numbers. Something that you sort of mentioned, George, is we sort of see this up and down when it comes to numbers. So when we talk about testing, what's typically shown on, you know, our daily numbers, that's usually from the PCR test. But we also have other types of tests. So sometimes some people may opt for, say, the rapid antigen test, and that may not necessarily be reflected on, you know, in our daily active numbers.
Okay, and then now that we have these home kits, where is that going to fall under?
So that's also at the moment, they're sort of trying to figure it out. But what we are trying to do is to also have that be captured under MySejahtera and sort of have this sort of virtual management going on. So to be able to have people who test positive sort of just key in, you know, I'm doing okay today, or, you know, I have slight symptoms today. But at the moment, it's again not captured under the active cases that we see every day.
Okay. Our Deputy DG, Dr. Chong, has said the size of the outbreak is far larger than the numbers detected each day. Our daily numbers are actually underreported. So how would you know? What's a realistic number?
So I think the common assumption, so this sort of goes back to the positivity rate. I'm not going to go over the math on a Friday afternoon, but I think we should be testing close to double or triple the amount of numbers. But our testing capacity right now in Malaysia, so it's across around 100 labs, so these are both government and private facilities, is close to 125,000. In terms of rapid tests that I mentioned earlier, we're doing about 80 to 90,000 of that. So so every day you're probably looking at about 150 or so. So if we want to double or triple that, then we definitely also need a lot more manpower.
I mean, Kumita, you, Mira mentioned about WHO's recommendation of positivity rate of less than 5. I mean, ours is between 10 to 12%. Can you give us some idea why is our rate so high? And also, how are we compared to, of course, don't compare with Singapore, but compare with Thailand and also neighboring Indonesia?
Okay, so, just to sort of give everyone an idea of what sort of the best country, for lack of a better word, right now. So I think New Zealand is the one which has one of the lowest positivity rates. I think theirs is about 1%, which is great. Australia is pretty low too. And when you're looking at numbers like that, it actually becomes really, really easy to manage the infection, because say you have, you know, one person who's infected, even when it comes to contact tracing, it's so easy. You're not sort of dealing with this huge mass number, and you know, when you are dealing with numbers like that, it does become very, very difficult. And so you end up having, you know, what you think are sporadic cases, but it may just be that you may have sort of missed, you know, who were in close contact with each other just because how large the numbers are that we're dealing right now.
So if our numbers, and if you say we should be testing double or triple the amount, what does this mean? How do we use this data to understand the situation? Which means, do we triple the number of positive cases? Is that what you're saying? Double or triple the actual cases that's out there in the community?
Yeah, so we are probably missing out on a couple or quite a few people out there right now. But again, just to sort of emphasize, that's also because a lot of people are asymptomatic, and those are quite challenging to trace unless we sort of go with the Olympic route, which is, you know, what's going on right now, where they actually test everyone every single day with the rapid test. But, you know, that does take up a lot of resources, that does take up a lot of time. And I'm not sure if that's, you know, if that's sort of the best way to go about it.
Okay. So what you're saying is keep an eye on the category 3, 4, and 5, are you saying? And then to keep an eye out on the death rate as well, which is probably going to give you a better indication. George, you have anything else to add on before we move on after the break to contact tracing?
Yeah. I mean, Kamita, I mean, obviously our positivity rate is between 10 to 12%. Mm-hmm. Can you explain a little bit what has gone wrong? We're in a lockdown for 2 months now. Why are we having such a large positivity rate?
I think that's sort of a question that's on everyone's mind right now. I think, to be honest, I think when we think about our daily lives, there are a lot of interactions that we have that we may not even realize. So, for example, if you think about what we did in the past 2 weeks, who we interacted with, we may think of sort of the immediate people, our family, if we are at work, you know, our co-workers. But there's also sort of this, you know, maybe we stepped out to get some food from the Food Panda rider, or we stepped out to get a package. And those may be people that we may not have captured through our MySejahtera, because, you know, all those, you know, other systems are not linked with each other. So I think that there are a lot of cases where it sort of falls through the cracks, and we just don't think about it, just because, you know, they are very short moments. In the past, when we were dealing with the original strain, the first strain that came out, that was a lot easier to keep track of, because, you know, you needed to be in close contact with someone for 15 minutes, or, you know, if it wasn't close contact, you needed to be in the same space with someone for 2 hours. But when you're dealing with something like the Delta variant, it just takes a couple of seconds. So it's hard, because you can walk past someone. You can walk past someone, and, you know, we wouldn't even know that we were actually, you know, may have accidentally infected that person.
Walk past someone, George. I don't know. Are you still seeing patients, George? How do you deal with it?
This is why I'm not coming into the studio. Otherwise, you're running away, right?
Do you like tell them don't breathe while I examine you? What do you do,
I
George?
Hold my breath. Don't do that. I can do that very long time.
We'll come back and find out more about this whole sporadic or unlinked cases in the community. How do you even start contact tracing now, right? Does it even matter anymore? Coming up next, if you have a question for Dr. Kumita or Dr. George Lee, give us a call. It's 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, or tweet us at BFM Radio. Good afternoon and welcome back. It's our Doctor in the House series. Dr. George Lee, consultant neurologist, my co-host this afternoon on a Friday. And joining us, Dr. Kumita Tevudas. She's from the Infectomics Cluster, Advanced Medical and Dental Institute at University Science Malaysia. We're trying to understand COVID-19 and where we really are at the moment. We went through some chat about the number of cases, the positivity rate, how it is underreported because we're not testing. We should be testing at least twice or three times the number, which is possibly not feasible at this stage, given our limitations. But what you're saying, Dr. Kumita, is we will need to assume that the numbers are at least twice to three times the actual number that's reported on a daily basis. Am I correct? Yeah. And also, let's talk about, I mean, you spoke about how we can't seem to detect or figure out where this disease, where you're actually getting infected. We often hear about, and the DG has said that almost 70% of our cases from January to June this year were due to sporadic or unlinked cases in the community. So basically, sporadic means you don't know where it came from, lah. Am I correct?
Yeah, that's right. So sporadic means that you can't link the cases to any particular cluster. So if you can do that, it's actually a lot easier. You can say, all right, you know, it's cluster A, which is basically from this particular location. So it's a lot easier even to just continue contact tracing. But if you don't know where you got it from, then there's a very, very high chance there's a lot more other people out there who also got infected the same way and may just not realize it.
Okay, so if 70% are sporadic, why are we contact tracing? Does it even matter anymore?
It actually does. I mean, I think contact tracing will always be a very, very important part in this pandemic. FTTIS, find, test, trace, isolate and support. So even though we may not be able to sort of say, all right, this person is linked to cluster A, but, you know, we can still contact trace for that person, right? We know maybe, okay, this person contacted 10 other people. We can still contact trace and go from there. And the most important thing right now is to be able to isolate them, just to make sure that the infection, to break the chain, to make sure that the infection doesn't continue going on.
Okay, so you still think that we should contact trace, even though we don't know, where it comes from. George, you have anything else to add on?
I mean, is it even possible? On a daily basis, we have, you know, 17,000 people who are infected. To contact trace on a daily basis like that, how many workforce, how many manforce do we actually have contact tracing at the moment?
I don't know the exact numbers, but every day, so I actually work in the COVID lab. So every day when we get samples in, I'm always very astounded by how they actually went about it. Because again, you know, assuming each person actually contacted 10 people, and all this contact tracing is actually done manually, because sometimes, you know, not everyone uses a mobile phone, not everyone scans the MySejahtera. Some people just write their names down, right? Or maybe they spoke to someone, but, you know, obviously not everyone carries a QR code with them. So it is a lot of work. It's an extensive, huge amount of work. And I actually have a lot of respect for them who actually do it. And they do it so quickly as well. So usually when someone is identified as a positive person, they usually are able to contact trace within 24 or at most 48 hours. So they're extremely, extremely quick about it.
You know, that's that rate of infectivity for the Delta variant. Is it 1 in 8? Like, you know, you have the chance of transmitting the Delta variant to 8 people. Am I correct? Is it 8 or is it more? It doesn't come to my mind now.
Yeah, it's about 5 to 8 in comparison to the very first strain that we were dealing with. And that's just because the amount of viral load, once someone is infected with Delta variant, is about 1,000-fold in comparison to the very first strain.
Oh, wow.
Staggering numbers.
So what, a few seconds of the food panda people breathing next to you, and then now it's 1,000-fold. Yep. We might as well just lock the doors now.
Yeah, so I mean, so we've come to a stage where some people are saying we just have to assume everybody is positive, right?
I think that's a fair assumption.
So if we all assume we're positive, we all have to stay at home, lah. Nobody can come to work at all. So then what happens, right? I think that's a very tough situation. Somebody help me to make sense of it, because we've come to a stage where it's impossible. We need to go out to get groceries, and, you know, some people in essential service need to work and all of that, till our vaccination rates get up to a reasonable number. Is it given that many of us will lose our lives? Many of us will become positive.
That sounds
till we get there, you know.
I guess I consider myself a very positive, not like in a positive COVID sort of manner, but a very optimistic person. I still want to say that, you know, because of how fast we are vaccinating, I think that we'll actually be okay. You know, sort of based on the predictions, sort of looking at the number of adults in Malaysia, we're actually supposed to reach herd immunity in a couple of weeks. So I hope, you know, sort of hearing that gives people hope that it'll be okay in a couple of weeks.
George?
About 2-3 months ago, I mean, we did a show and then we highlighted that people should really get registered. Otherwise, we will be like the situation in India. Obviously, some people say that we are already in a situation like India. We don't actually hear too much about India, you know, infectivity rate and also how they deal with it afterwards. I mean, can you highlight a little bit, perhaps, you know, are we really as serious as how India was 2 months ago? And how did India get out of such situation?
Good question again. So I don't think we are as serious as India. I think we're still okay. I think because, you know, when you sort of look at where the serious cases really are, it's mostly sort of localized in Klang Valley. And that's just because there's a lot of movement. It's extremely dense. The other states are somewhat okay. But sort of going back to what happened in India, they did a seroprevalence test. So it's just to find out how many people actually have antibodies against COVID. So you actually get antibodies when you've been vaccinated or you've been infected. And they actually found out that close to 70% of them actually had been infected, but they didn't actually realize that. I saw a study today as well where I think they actually showed something similar in Lab 1. I don't know, I haven't really sort of looked at the details of it, but it is actually possible that a lot of people actually have been infected, didn't realize it just because, you know, they were asymptomatic and they actually are protected. Otherwise, again, you know, you have your vaccines going at a super fast rate. So I don't think we'll ever sort of reach what India went through.
Okay. But 80% of the population in Lab 1 has been vaccinated. So they're in a much better place. But I suppose for all of us asymptomatic and then we recover, we will have antibodies, right? But we won't know. We will never know. Do you think this testing for antibodies will be a big thing after this? Already we have people who are imagining they never got vaccinated and all want to do antibody tests. So how now?
I actually did see that. I think, again, we have to be very cautious about it. So when we talk about antibodies, just to, you know, fun fact, I guess. So if you've actually been infected and then you were vaccinated, your antibody levels are extremely high. It's actually higher than someone who didn't get infected but just got vaccinated. And, you know, and that's higher than someone who got infected but not vaccinated. But all three actually does provide protection. So I think, you know, when talking about antibodies, there is this sort of variation even among people. So it's quite hard to sort of just go and be like, all right, I want to test because I want to know whether I got vaccinated or not, because you're always going to get sort of very, very different responses people to people.
So, I mean, Kamita, earlier on you highlighted the India situation. Naturally, it's just like the natural immunity kind of, really. Do you think, obviously, you need to go through that hurdle of the absolute critical situation and before you build that? Do you think, you know, we have kind of like reached the peak of that infectivity in Malaysia and then begin to get that antibodies, and on top of that we're getting the extra speed of the vaccination? I'm hoping that that is the our saving grace in order to reduce the number of death in the country.
Yeah, so I actually think that's where we are at right now. I mean, I think, you know, this is probably as high as we could go, you know, maybe at most like a week or two or so of this. And then we should actually start seeing a decrease in cases, at least with severe cases. We should start seeing a decrease in death. And again, you know, that that's just based on the prediction and a lot of different trends and calculation. But I think they're sort of at the peak right now.
Okay, that's a good thing. We hope to see things going down after this. So the Delta variant is, of course, as we've discussed, it's very infectious, right? I mean, the DG has said 15 seconds, and it can transmit, right? Do we need to ramp up on genomic sequencing? And that's what you do, isn't it, Dr. Kumita?
I do a lot of genomics work, yes. So at the moment, we have currently sequenced about 1,600 or so cases. So that's about 0.17% of positive cases. And then, of course, recently, the ministry also announced that they would be providing funding, and that would give us another 3,000 cases that we could sequence. I think knowing what variant is prevalent would be really helpful, because it definitely helps with mitigation, with controlling and all that. And just to sort of give people how fast Delta is close to taking over, is when we look at the data in early June of Malaysia. Back then we had about 100 cases of Beta, and we only had about 10 cases of Delta. But right now, so this was, I think, 2 days ago or so, we actually have about 200 cases of Beta, and we have close to 200 cases of Delta as well. So Delta has actually so quickly caught up with, you know, and it's close to overtaking Beta right now. We are sampling actively. There are actually sort of three criteria that's used to sample patients. The first is when we do our PCR tests and we get a cycle threshold value of 25 and below. So that actually tells us that the viral load is really high, and so that person most likely is carrying the Delta variant. So that's one of it. We also do sequence within high positivity rate clusters. So if we suddenly see this, you know, cluster of 60 people or so suddenly popping up in the span of 2 days, chances are that probably is also a Delta variant in that cluster. The third is when people are brought in dead, BID, because again, that sort of suggests that maybe the disease has progressed very quickly, again, indicating maybe high viral load. So maybe Delta variant and ICU cases. I think we would definitely benefit from sequencing more. That would help us greatly.
Can't hear you, George.
Other subtype or other variant, are we sequencing any other variants at all? Because, you know, last we interviewed an expert, Dr. Petri, was actually telling us that in the future, he's anticipating this time next year, we'll be facing more variants. Are we doing that at the moment?
So we can only at the moment, we are sequencing, we are looking for what we categorize as VOC, variant of concern. So we're looking for alpha, beta, delta, and then there's also VOI, variants of interest. So that's kappa, theta, and eta. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right. But in the future, so when you talk about viruses in general, especially with SARS-CoV-2, the mutation rate is quite high. So you do see roughly about one mutation in every 2 weeks or so. But it is sort of important to point out that usually whenever you have mutations, there usually is no sort of drastic difference in the effect. They typically don't become more dangerous just because they rely on human hosts to survive. So they sort of just, you know, sort of evolve so that it's easier for them to transmit, which is what we're seeing right now in Delta. And when we talk about mutations, it can only happen if there are a lot of people that the virus can infect, because that sort of gives them more opportunity to continue mutating. So eventually, when we get herd immunity, when people are more protected, that also lowers the risk of mutation. So my hope is that, you know, by this time next year, we won't see any new mutations, you know, and I'm hopeful that's what will happen.
Yeah. I mean, viruses are like that, isn't it? The intention is never to kill the host, because if they kill the host, they die.
Yeah,
they have
exactly.
Nothing, right? They have nothing to live on. So the idea is not to kill the host, but then as Delta is, it's slightly mutated and it spreads right? It spreads really easily, and that's what the mutation is at the moment, isn't it? Okay, we'll come back and continue this discussion if you have a question on COVID-19 screening, testing and the Delta variant. We're talking about antibodies. We're going to come up and talk about vaccines after this and what happens. Do we need booster shots? A lot of chatter about that. All of that coming up next. If you have a question, give us a call, 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, or tweet us at BFM Radio. Good afternoon and welcome back. It's our Doctor in the House series, Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist, my co-host on a Friday, always on a Friday. It's either me or T. Xiaowick, he co-hosts with, you know, the constant for the last coming up to 13 years now. September 4th, George, you know, BFM will be 13 years and you've been here that long.
I'm part of the furniture.
Yes, you are. Yeah. But, you know, but you always had this problem that we only promoted you to co-host only, right? 13 years and you only got to co-host. You couldn't do more than that. But that's okay. We're talking about COVID-19. On the line with us also, Dr. Kumita Tevdas from Infectomics Cluster, Advanced Medical and Dental Institute from University Science Malaysia. We're just discussing how bad COVID-19 is. We've gone through a fair bit. We've covered a fair bit, actually, about a lot of our concerns. So you're saying we should ramp up gene testing or genomic sequencing, Dr. Kumita, but we did speak to a virologist who argued that, you know, which comes first? Should we be testing more or should we be doing the genomic sequencing, you know? What are your thoughts on that?
I think they both go hand in hand. You know, it's only if we test more that we are actually able to identify more people who are infected. And, you know, over time, we also hope that will give us a lot more clues about what's going on. You know, do we sort of see more Delta? But over time, do we sort of see that people are only asymptomatic? Or if there's a new variant in the future, it would do us well to be able to quickly determine that and sort of figure out what to do next. So, I mean, I'm definitely an advocate of both.
Okay. And now we're ramping up vaccinations. It would feel like, you know, we just need to vaccinate ourselves out of this. There's no other way, right? There's really no other way. When do you think we will be able to see some sort of impact?
So I think according to the calculations in Malaysia right now, we should reach herd immunity. So this is just among the adults in early September. If we do include teenagers, but I think we're still sort of off on the fence about that, then we're looking at early October. I know as with different vaccine companies like Pfizer, for example, they are sort of testing in different groups of people as well. So, you know, the hope is, who knows, maybe they will offer vaccination to kids below 12 as well in time.
Okay. We have a question from Lynn. Lynn, you're on the line. How are you today?
Hi, good, Mira.
Hi. You have a question.
I came in halfway, so I didn't get the name of the good doctor.
Dr. Kumita.
Dr. Kumita, okay. Basically, my question is like this. If a person's immunity is low, by the measure of the total white blood count below the minimum, if the person takes the jab at this stage, does it mean that the chances of it to produce a COVID antibody is low or nil at all?
Okay, so if you have a low white blood count, how does that impact the development of antibodies when you get vaccinated? Thank you very much, Lynn, for that. Dr. Kumita?
Yeah, sorry.
You have another question?
No, I mean the white blood count is below the minimum.
Yep.
Yeah. If this person were to take the jab now, would it be effective in producing the antibody? And the second question that wasn't answered in another program, earlier program, is that I have someone that I know, 35 years old, healthy male, contracted COVID positive, but mild one, end of last year, not hospitalized. After healing, right, he took the test twice but produced zero antibody. So recently he completed two doses of the vaccine, he has no choice. So I just curious, just now I heard Dr. Kumita said that after the jab will be, after the person contracted the virus should have antibody. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Lynn. Thank you very much. You want to go with the first one first?
Sure. Thank you, Lynn, again, for calling in. Both very interesting questions. So the first question was about, in general, if your white blood cells are low, would you still benefit from taking the vaccines? And the answer is definitely yes. So as mentioned briefly earlier, we do get, you know, really various levels of antibody among patients. And sometimes we sort of, you know, even if that sort of boosts the antibody just a little bit, that's still protective. So right now, you know, even though there's been, I think, over 90 over studies of vaccine efficacy that's been going around globally, they still don't quite know for sure yet where sort of that threshold to say that, okay, you know, anything 5 and below is not protective, or 5 and above is protective. And this is sort of seen yet across, you know, all the different studies. So I would say definitely, you know, for Lynn's first question, if you do have the chance to go get vaccinated, yes, please do. And, you know, you can also sort of talk to the doctor about it when you do go get vaccinated, sort of what are the different choices of vaccine. And, you know, you can sort of understand how the different vaccines work as well. But the answer to the first question is yes. And then her second question was, I believe she said she knew someone who got
35-year-old person, end of last year, was positive, not hospitalized, but has no antibodies upon checking.
Okay, so I think it sort of depends on how long it's been. So, you know, if the person got infected last year and the person sort of, you know, did an antibody test, say, this year in July, you know, that may have been like a span of 1 year. So there are sort of studies sort of popping up that say that they are seeing antibodies decrease after a couple of months. So it may just be that, you know, it's been a very long time, a year or so. And so that's why the antibody levels have decreased.
But patients who have recovered from COVID are advised to get vaccinated after a certain period of time?
Yeah, correct. So because when we talk about protection, it's not just antibodies as well. I'm not going to go in detail too much, but basically our immune system is complex, but it's also very robust. So you have things like memory cells, memory B cells, which still would sort of remember if it sees the virus again. All right, you know, everyone sort of get ready to protect the body. We also have T cells, which would also sort of be ramped up very quickly. So T cells would then destroy the infected cells. So, you know, it's not just the antibodies. The hope is that people realize that, you know, once we do get infected or once we are vaccinated, our bodies are a lot more prepared to deal with future infections.
Tell us a little bit more about this memory. I was just reading about it the other day and I found it quite fascinating that, you know, your cells actually have memory. I thought only our muscles had memory. It's like our cells also have memory.
Yep. So I would say, I think the easiest way to sort of think about that is, if, and this is how I sort of explain it to little kids, I guess, if you see someone in a blue coat and you know that person is dangerous, even if you see this blue coat, you know, a while later, a year later or something, you still sort of already remember, you know, sort of like a nightmare or something, like, okay, you know, this is bad. Let's quickly attack. So, I mean, it is something that's very valuable. It's something that we do use quite a lot when it comes to infections.
George?
Well, early on, we talk about people who are infected and then also their protection and efficacy of the vaccine. I'm sure Mira is going to ask you later, you know, a lot of people who are fully vaccinated, and then, you know, what's going to happen? You know, what is it? Why are we hearing more and more of these people are being vaccinated, but yet get infected? And also, just before the show, we heard in the news that in the States they are promoting the booster for over 60s in the US, mm-hmm. and also in Israel. Can you give us your opinion on that?
Okay, so I'll answer the second question first. So for the efficacy test that I mentioned earlier, there was a pretty big study that was published where they looked at about 600 people and they saw that and in this 600 people, it was mostly for those 60 and above, and they saw that their antibody rates dropped after about 3 months or so. But again, you know, we are dealing with the older population in general. In general, the immune system is not as robust, it's not as active as someone who's a bit younger. And this is true, you know, regardless of whether it's an infection or just in general. So in that case. That is sort of probably why Israel is going ahead with the booster shot. And with Israel, they are also able to do that because a large number of their population is already vaccinated. So I think there's always this sort of debate, you know, when should you offer someone a booster third shot? And if the option is offering a booster third shot right now to everyone, or sort of making sure everyone, as many people, are vaccinated first, complete their first two doses first, I would say we should probably go with the later option. George, I sort of forgot what your first question was.
The people who are fully vaccinated and mm-hmm. also who get infected, especially, you know, healthcare frontliners.
Okay, so those are called breakthrough infections. So when you're fully vaccinated and you still are able to get infected. The thing to remember about this is, again, sort of from all the studies, the vaccines in general, they are able to protect against hospitalization 90% of the time. So hospitalization means, again, when we talk about categories, that's category 3, 4, and 5. They're able to protect against mild infections about 60% of the time. So that's why it's okay to be vaccinated and then, you know, sort of if you are exposed to an infection, but in most of the cases, you would see that they are mild or asymptomatic. And that's sort of what we are hoping for, to reduce hospitalization.
The antibody levels could wane with time, however.
Mm-hmm. So that's what a lot of studies have been done in older people right now. And the current numbers, you know, it range anywhere from 3 months to some people have shown 6 months to 8 months. So I don't think there's any sort of, you know, set number that we can say, all right, everyone, you know, after 6 months, go get a booster. I would still say we need a lot more studies to actually be able to conclude on that.
Okay, so maybe we need to get our head out of this antibody craziness. How much do I have? Think mm-hmm. about this memory as well, memory of the cells, which is, you know, something we cannot measure yet. Mm-hmm. Am I correct? Okay, so just assume you're okay, lah. Take the two doses
yes.
and assume you're fine, right?
And assume you're okay, yes.
Assume you're okay. I mean, of course, do the necessary, wear your mask, distance and all of that. And we'll take it from there. The Prime Minister is thinking of relaxing some restrictions for fully vaccinated individuals, Dr. Kumita. Meanwhile, you know, and that's happening in the UK. Of course, that's an entirely different story. But the WHO has cautioned that social mixing is one of the factors that leads to a rise in some of these cases. So what are your thoughts on that? Do you think we should or we shouldn't?
Okay, I'm going to start with a disclaimer. So my disclaimer is that I've been fully vaccinated. So have my entire family and close friends and all my co-workers. So of course, when I hear something like this, I'm overjoyed because I would be thrilled to be able to see my parents again. But I think it would be quite challenging trying to figure out the logistics of it. So what Singapore, for example, they announced recently was that they are going to allow dine-in for groups of 5 if everyone has actually completed their vaccination. So the way they calculate that is you've completed both doses and you're at least 2 weeks or more after the second dose. If you haven't been vaccinated, then they say that you actually have to take like a rapid test, show that you're negative, and only then be able to join that party of 4, 3 or so on. And if you have kids and kids are not vaccinated, usually it's okay to join as long as the parents are fully vaccinated. But I think it sort of gets very complex very easily, because how do you sort of keep track of that? And, you know, maybe the patrons are fully vaccinated, but then does it mean that, you know, if you're the restaurant owner or if you're the wait staff, then you also have to be fully vaccinated, you know, in order for something like that to happen? So I'm not sure who is willing to sort of, you know, do that sort of work to do this constant monitoring. I'm sort of on the fence about that, actually.
I think it's social responsibility. We want to relax. We need to take responsibility. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, cannot allow. It's not going to happen. Okay, your message for us, Dr. Kumita. Would you have a message for us?
Overall, you know what? I think I know a lot of people have been sort of feeling down about what's been going on. But again, you know, I'm a big advocate of vaccination. I think we'll get there eventually in a couple of weeks or so. So hang on, everyone. It's not too bad and things will definitely get better soon.
George? On mute.
I was accused of being over optimistic last week. Right? Okay. Look at Dr. Peter, more optimistic than I am, right? Okay, despite the whole 15-second hold my breath, and then also, you know, the infectivity rate of like 90% or so, I think she's right that we're hoping that this is the end of the worst. You know, we got over the worst, and hopefully, with a lot of us developing the immunity plus also the vaccination, we really will see the light at the tunnel.
Thank you very much, both of you, for joining me today. Dr. Kumita Tevdas from Infectomics Cluster, Advanced Medical and Dental Institute, University Science Malaysia. And of course, my co-host, Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist in our Doctor in the House series this Friday on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.